When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Audio.
Are you fucking kidding me? For the one guy that's worried about keeping the podcast, you're on like 1 minute before the guest.
You don't know what the fuck I'm going
That's fine.
Right
then
now,
next
you...
Jesus Christ. Then respond and get on and say, I can't do it.
I'm on. Jesus fucking Christ.
What are you going through?
On.
What are you going through? Trying to fit into that pink robe behind you?
No, you dick. I'm coming off of my fucking anti-depression medication. I'm having the craziest withdrawal symptoms that are fucking me up really, really badly. So I'm trying to deal with it. And I'm not feeling great right now, and I've had to wake myself up. And it's nothing you'd understand because you're fucking perfect.
I'm not perfect, but I'm closer than you.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. Good God. Don't get on all fucking crab ass. We're not doing Michael Ian Black's interview with you coming out of some fog. How about this? Stay on the antidepressant and kill the weed for a week.
My God, you and the weed. It's the toss-up. Do I want to fucking sweat or do I want to be not crazy? I don't know, man. It's a hard one.
Yeah, but you don't even know that if you get off your antidepressant that you're going to start sweating.
Pretty sure because it's starting to happen. You know.
Good. Are you sweating right now?
On the inside. No, I mean, here's the thing. I've been on this fucking antidepressant, which I'm not depressed. It was for anxiety. I was in Nashville, blah, blah, blah. For 5.5 years, I don't even need to be on it really, but just generally don't need to be on it. It's just been a part of my daily routine. And now I'm coming off of it because I got to figure out my body and why I'm not perspiring. And we've talked about this, but prior, you know, when I was on it in my 20s, at the same thing, and I went off my Celexa, and, you know, I started to sweat again. I'm sure this is the reason why I'm not sweating, because I'm starting to sweat again a little bit.
Good.
But the withdrawal symptoms of this, which, you know, I didn't have last time for whatever reason, are just fucking gnarly. They're not fun.
How many milligrams were you on? Like a heavy dose
on,
or a middle dose?
I was on 20. I don't even know. I was on 20 milligrams, and then, you know, I weaned off to 2 to 2.5 very slowly, and then, you know, I stopped. It's not uncommon. Of course, I've been reading about it, but it's just not.
That's well known.
It's not fun.
I think it's good, especially if you're starting to perspire. That's exciting.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's just not fun, dude. It's borderline, you know, nutty. And in the morning, it's just when you're foggy and whatever, you wake up and you're like, fuck. You don't feel like there's multiple kinds of symptoms, but it's like you're disconnected from your body. You're disconnected from reality, just slightly. You know, it's like, woo, fuck.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, it's weird. It's really, really weird.
Sounded for a minute like you were doing lyrics from a John Mayer song.
Well, I wish my body was a wonderland. I can tell you that. It's not a wonderland, so. But yeah,
mine's awesome.
No, I'm starting to feel better even right now. It's just that when I wake up, this morning especially, I wake up and just like, whoa, fuck, man. First of all, I usually wake up at like 7 o'clock normally. And I get up and it's like 8:40. I'm like, Jesus, I have weirdest dreams. I dreamt I was sweating.
Good.
Last night I dreamt I was sweating.
Maybe your mind is just going to start telling your body either while you're sleeping or you can't. Couldn't you just pack yourself?
My body's telling me yes.
If you wore that hoodie to bed and cranked the heat up,
no.
Would you not sleep in sweat?
No, that's not how it works. No,
it's like people that have been through COVID who can't taste or smell. They're supposed to. I've read where you burn an orange peel and you eat the orange peel to get your sense of smell and taste back. So you have to do something to kickstart the engines here and get them
right.
going.
Well, I've tried, you know. I've tried like infrared sauna, blah, blah, blah. But it's not, that's not the way it works with this. I don't think there's a kickstart, you know. But it's happening slowly, slowly. It's just,
I can tell you this.
This will end.
If I were listening to this podcast right now, I would have definitely stopped listening by this point.
No way. See, I disagree. This was one of our newest intros ever, me screaming at you and then
coming
to.
Delete it.
No way.
I would unsubscribe because I'm so tired of hearing these two guys whine.
It's not whining. I mean, it's just my reality, you know, and I wasn't planning on coming on and, you know, sort of talking about this morning. But when you're giving me shit, Mike, what's up?
How are you?
Hi, so, Michael Ian Black.
How are you, brother?
Good to see you again.
Here's what's going on.
That was your answer? How you doing? Whatever.
Well, hey, I can relate to that.
What a lovely sunroom you have there.
Thank you
home.
So much.
Yes. Mm. Where are you? New York? Connecticut? Where are you?
That's right. The wilds of Connecticut is where
I am. It looks Connecticut-y. Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
But Michael, it looks like an Ansel Adams picture.
Let me just explain to you what's happening right now, okay? So I was late getting on. We usually do a little preamble, and I was a little late getting on. I'm fucking tired. And here's what's happening, okay? I've been on antidepressants. I've been on Lexapro for about 5.5 years. I'm not going to go through the whole story, but I'm coming off of it. Down to 2.5 milligrams. I've been weaning off very nicely, and then I stopped like I should. These fucking withdrawal symptoms that I'm having are so gnarly, and it's just making my life a bit insane.
What are
and Joe comes on like, what the fuck, dude? You're on 30 seconds before and giving me shit. So I'm yelling at him. And now I'm trying to explain what's happening. And then you come on. So I'm just downloading you.
Yeah. I mean, what are the symptoms? Anger?
Yeah.
Yeah. General lethargy.
It's just you feel like disconnected from your body. You know, it's you're just tired and you're disconnected. And it's like these brain zaps and.
Why are you getting off the pills? The pills are terrific.
They're great. No, I know. Well, here's the thing. I don't necessarily need them. It seems like I do now. Yeah, I know. But
I agree. You're making the case for Lexapro or whatever the hell you're on.
It was fucking up my body in a way that is not allowing me to perspire and sweat. Okay.
Oh, that's weird.
So it's very strange. And it happened in my 20s, went off of it, and I was back on about 5 years ago, and this last year started happening. I'm not able to sweat, and that's been screwing me up. So as I've come off, it's starting to sweat a little bit, so I know that this is the reason. So it's what I was saying to Joe. It's either sanity or sweating, and I have to make a choice.
Mm-hmm. How much do you value perspiration?
A lot.
Clearly.
A lot, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when he puts it that way, that's a really good question. I mean, you're valuing perspiration over sanity. This is apples or oranges, and oranges will lead you to
this will end, though. I mean, these withdrawals will end, I hope.
But at that point, so the withdrawal symptoms end. You're sweating. I mean, yeah. you can't – the sheen is unbelievable. You can't believe the sheen.
Oh, God, yeah. And then, right now.
And then mentally, what happens to you? Like depression wise, what happens to you?
No, nothing. You know, so I was doing a show in Nashville for 2 years, right? I had three kids, the back and forth. I was nuts. This was five or six years ago. And I started to have this anxiety, and boom, I had a bit of an anxiety attack, and I started to fall into these old patterns of anxiety that I had in my early 20s. Not as bad, but they were getting there. And so I said, oh, fuck, man, I don't want to go down that road again, because that was really bad. And so then I went back on an antidepressant, and it worked. It sort of evened me out. But I didn't need to be on it for that long. It just became a part of my daily routine.
Right.
When I, even after I finished Nashville 3.5-4 years ago, you know. So that's the thing. I don't need them to survive to really regulate me. You know, I needed it for a specific situation, but I overshot it, basically.
I had a experience, maybe a year ago, where I've been on citalopram, one of those, mm-hmm. for years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the prescription expired, and I was kind of too lazy to refill the prescription, so I went cold turkey.
Yeah.
And then about 10 days to 2 weeks later, I was in the darkest place I feel like I've ever been in.
Mm.
And it took me a minute to understand that those two events might be related.
Like, right.
You'd think I would have connected that sooner.
But yeah.
I feel like my wife helped me connect it. And then she was like, yeah, you really need to get back on those things. And I did. And it's that I'm ever grateful that I did, because that was really
with fun. Unexpired medication. Right?
I don't know. I bought them from a guy. I didn't check the date. I don't know.
A guy. You bought them from a guy.
It was a guy. I don't know.
You had a white coat on. I don't know.
Oh, man, feel free, Michael, just to dump out of this. If I got on a podcast and the host was talking about how depressed he was, I don't know that I'd continue on with the interview. But
are you kidding? I'm much more interested in talking about somebody else than myself.
Mm-hmm. No, look, I'm not depressed. I'm just going through the shit. You know what I mean? But thanks for listening, Mike. And we'll see you next time, bud.
Yeah, no, this was great. I really appreciate it. And, you know, honestly, like Bitcoin, Ethereum, like however you want to handle it, it's fine with me.
Yes. Good. So
shouldn't you be in a stadium right now? I mean, the season is kicked off. And
yeah, you would think. I don't do a ton of baseball. I do a lot more football, but I had a game this past week, which was one of these where I live in St. Louis. So I was in a studio in St. Louis. The game was Atlanta at Philadelphia. So the game's in Philly. The guy I do the games with, John Smoltz, was in Atlanta, and our producer and director were in LA. So we're kind of piecing all of that together and trying to make it seem as normal as possible. And for the most part, it sounds okay. It's just hard to... I'm just doing a game off TV, which for convenience sake is great. I don't have to leave there and go scramble to the airport. But for actual performance in the job, it makes it a little bit tougher. And we had audio dumped out and video was bad. And I'm trying to fake my way through this thing. So it was a bit of a hectic Saturday. But that's, you know, that's where we are.
I think when that happens, you just do swing and a miss. You know?
Yeah.
You're going to be right most of the time.
Yeah. Fouled off to the right.
You're just playing the odds.
Yeah. Oh, and that's, you just got a piece of it. I mean, that could be anything. That could be anything. You know, I have known you, Michael, tangentially through people you've worked with. I've been friends with Rudd forever. So I've heard through him how brilliant your comedy is. And when I do the research, go through it about you, I mean, we have this show Daddy Issues that has a through line of everybody's got daddy issues. Some are good, some are bad, some are whatever, neither one of the two. But I feel like you're one of the first people that we've talked to that really thinks about this a lot, where you've written an op-ed piece after a mass shooting, you have a son that you're raising, and you've basically written a book that's kind of an open letter to him in a way.
Basically, it sounds like I didn't write a book. It sounds like you're putting a
I wrote a book. Mine was basically, mine was basically, so I can't project onto you, but you really think about this stuff, which I'm a bit intimidated to talk, because we kind of joke about the fact that we're not professionals talking about this. I know you're not, but this is something that, you know, how to raise kids and specifically a son in today's world is, it's becoming more and more difficult, I feel.
It's certainly become more nuanced, I think, than it used to be. I think it used to be, you know, you have a son in particular and you just sort of say, go play outside, and you check back in 18 years. And that doesn't seem to be working as well these days. Mm-hmm. Because we've spent a lot of time over the last 25 years looking at the girls and going, hey, we really need to like lift up girls and give them this message, important message of empowerment and equality and sexual agency and all this stuff, all of which is super important. And I'm really glad we've done that. There has been a cost, I think, to the way boys are being raised. It's sort of funny to think like we haven't paid enough attention to the boys, when for the history of humanity, basically boys have always been paying attention to. But I think it's true that because we have spent so much time focusing on girls' needs and lifting up girls and kind of redefining where girls fit in the culture, that has had some unintended consequences on boys.
Mm. And what are those?
In my case, a little too handsome.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. I know.
I think it is interesting, and I've read a lot of what you've put out there, and I agree with so much of it. I think it is interesting to put it in that context, though, because now we're on the back end as the three of us talk of a couple more shootings, and there's this like this kind of rage that seems to be out there, or these disenfranchised people that are looking for some outlet, and they're lonely, and they don't have, as you talk about, kind of an avenue to explore some of the stuff that that maybe we did when we were a kid. I know for me, I mean, I was a lot more free as a kid than I think kids are today. You know, for me in the Midwest, to be able to ride my bike all the hell all over the place and kind of have my own responsibility and be, you know, I had to be respectful of dinner time. But prior to dinner time, I mean, my parents didn't really know where I was, and I wasn't doing anything nuts, but I was on my own and having something that I had control of. And I think some of that has been taken away and maybe rightfully so with how crazy this world seems to be. But I don't know. Where can you put it into better words than I just tried to put it into?
I can try. And I thought those words were fine.
Thank you so much.
Swinging this.
Just got a piece of it.
I think the first part of what you said is absolutely right. Like, we're on the back end of these shootings, and, you know, knock on wood, there won't be any in the next few days, but who knows? And so that's what got me interested in thinking more deeply about this topic to begin with. After Sandy Hook, where I'm raising my kids, right next door to Sandy Hook, I really started paying attention to it. And then later, after the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, and I started asking the question, which I just had never asked, and I didn't hear anybody else asking the question. And it seems so obvious in retrospect. And the question is simple, like, why is it always boys who are committing these crimes? Why is it always boys pulling the trigger? Like, I was someone inclined to blame loose gun laws and, you know, corrupt politicians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I still do. However, the element of like masculinity in that, I felt like wasn't receiving any attention. And then whatever you feel about him, with the election of Donald Trump, we certainly saw the trope rising of the angry white man. I mean, it had been in the culture before, but I think it really kind of came to the fore with the election of Donald Trump. And so I was just asking, like, why? Like, what's going on with guys? And when I started looking into it, and when I started researching the book that I was writing, and again, I'm not an expert. I'm a C-list comedian. But when I started looking at it and really getting into the topic, what I started to realize is that there's deep historical roots to explain kind of what we're going on as a culture and what's going on with men in general. The easiest way, the easiest place to kind of to pin that would be the the feminist movement of the, let's say, mid to late 60s, you know, moving forward, when women really were able to move into the culture in a way that they hadn't been able to before, enter the workplace, establish financial autonomy, the introduction of the pill into the culture, and women were suddenly creating power for themselves, power that had been denied to them throughout history. And that is going to have an effect on every aspect of the culture, not the least of which is men's participation in the economy, men's control over women, men's and a sort of more fundamental level, the way men think of themselves and their roles in the culture. When that all starts to shift, and then you combine that with globalization and technological innovations, there's a segment of men and boys who feel like, I don't know who I'm supposed to be anymore. And that creates a lot of unease. And some of that gets, a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of that ends up getting manifested in these, you know, mass shootings, for example. Mm-hmm. But we see it in other ways too. We see it, the Time's Up movement and the Me Too movement. We see those behaviors sort of really examined and looked at. And we see the reaction to that when men are going, whoa, 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 you know, like, are you telling me like I can't look at a woman? You tell me I can't give a woman a compliment? And you see like all this froth in the culture. Some of it is necessary and healthy, and some of it is just a mess. That was a long-winded answer. I don't know.
No, I think it's awesome. Brilliant.
It's great because the timing of it, I mean, you can't deny the timing of everything you're saying.
I love what you said, Mike. You know, Michael, it's I have two boys and then I also have a little girl. How much do you think parenting is really where this comes from? You know, because essentially, you know, we parent the way that we were parented and sometimes trying to break that cycle, sometimes trying to emulate. How much of this also do you think is just ingrained into the male just from a primal standpoint? I'm just trying to get a little deeper into it, you know, and how much of this is actually cultural right now?
So I think you're asking two different questions. The first question is, how much is parenting itself to blame for sort of where we are? That's the first question. The second is, how much of aggression, like how much of this sort of aggressive, at times criminal behavior is biological?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll try to answer the second question first, and because it's easier for me. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's the biological answer. I don't know. However, I do think some of it is biological. I think it would be hard to explain the prevalence of violence in the male of our species versus the female of the species without attributing some of it to biological foundations. Mm-hmm. It just has to be. That being said, there are biological instincts that we as guys have that we curb all the time. I mean, we have terrible instincts as men, you know, like we just know we do, whether it's in people in general, but like, you know, the number of like women I have seen on the street who I've been like, God, you know, I'd love to be with her. You don't do it. You're curbing some sort of biological instinct. The same has to be true for violence. The same has to be true with all of the impulses that we have that are counterproductive to not only our own happiness, but the larger culture as a whole. Like, that's just what society is. Society is just figuring out, like, okay, how do we not destroy each other?
Mm-hmm.
So although I do think violence is probably somewhat ingrained in men, mm-hmm. I think we can do a better job of curbing it. In terms of parenting, I think I'd be a fool to say that parenting doesn't play an enormous role in terms of how, just keeping the conversation to boys think of their place in the world and express themselves in the world and mature or not. That being said, I think parenting is a component, a big component, but there are other components as well.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting because there's also, you're dealing with morality in a way. Morality is ever evolving, okay? 100 years ago, morality was just a different concept than it is today. So it's funny, we're almost chasing a moving target in a sense. Now, it might be a slow moving target, but you know, we're still evolving and we always will be evolving. And there needs to be some time to let it, sometimes some of us catch up to that evolution, you know. But it is a really interesting conversation, you know. And the other thing too is just, again, culturally, we're talking global for a second. There are just different people do different things in different ways, you know. I mean, we're specifically talking about Western civilization, I guess, right? I mean, is that what we're talking about? And then how do you deal with, you know, the rest of the world, so to speak?
Or it down further in terms of like my own book and my own musings on this. I would break it down to like white American guys, because okay. I don't feel comfortable saying like, the experience of me growing up is the same as a black kid growing up or a Latino kid growing up. Like, I don't know. I think there probably are similarities, you know, as Americans, as we grow up. Mm-hmm. But like when you talk about the phenomenon of mass shootings, for example, that's almost an entirely white male phenomenon.
Yeah.
I'm careful, like in the book that I wrote, like I'm careful, and it is addressed to my son as a letter to my son. And I'm pretty careful to say like, hey, this is written to you, a pretty privileged dude growing up in the wilds of Connecticut. I mean, I have a library ladder, so I'm doing okay.
Right.
That is the telltale sign. If somebody has a library ladder that looks like it's made out of, it's some sort of metal.
Yeah.
And so this isn't like, hey, we're just throwing
up. This isn't a balsa wood library ladder.
No, that looks very sturdy.
And it matches the trimmings on the window.
That's right.
So there's a decorative sense here where that's privilege.
You can hear it.
Oh, wow.
That's unreal.
Beautiful.
That's quality. That's a quality library ladder that you're probably not going to find outside of Connecticut.
If you like conversations with multi-talented comedians like today's episode with Michael Ian Black, who I'm in love with and currently have a major crush on, one of my favorite episodes, go check out the Daddy Issues archives and listen to our conversation with Joel McHale, who's also very buff and has an amazing hairline, where we discuss everything from sports to raising kids to OCD charity work and so, so much more.
OCD charity work?
No, like it's OCD, charity work.
Oh, I thought it was like, oh my God, so we got to raise the money for this
OCD
and then we got to go.
No. Just check, go check it out. Go check it out. With your dyslexia, though, that was discovered at a young age or was it not?
Oh, I mean, no, it was not. They didn't just diagnose it. They said stuff like, well, he's a slow starter, which is not a medical term. And they told that to my face. And I just thought, yeah, it seems about right. And we then had my older son tested and the woman began describing all these, the things that, everything that I go through. And I was like, oh, you're describing me. And she just goes, I was wondering which one of you, whether it's your wife or you, because it's passed down.
Wait, so you discovered your dyslexia through your son's diagnosis?
Yes. Wow. Yeah, that was fun.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after this short break with more from today's guest, Michael Ian Black.
The this is still so fucking fascinating. I love that you wrote this book. I love that we're talking about this. And even as we are talking about it, I have this feeling of, oh gosh, I don't want to say the wrong thing on a podcast that then gets broadcast into the world. We have to tread lightly, I guess, you know, which
say
I think
whatever,
is good.
Say whatever horrible shit you're thinking. I mean,
well,
you have
no, it's not even excuse. Horrible.
You're off your meds. Like if you this ever is... had a grace period, this is it.
This is true. But did you feel like you had to sort of tread lightly when you write about top subject matter and topics like this, being sort of a privileged white male with a letter to your privileged white son, or can you let it fly?
I tried to let it fly. I was only treading lightly in the sense of not wanting to speak for people that I couldn't speak for, you know, mm-hmm. But I didn't hold back in the things that I was saying to my son or hold back in what I was saying in the book. And, you know, I was also expressing some sympathy, surprising as I was writing, you know, surprising myself with the plight of white dudes, which is a totally un-PC thing to say, like mm-hmm. to express sympathy for white dudes at all. It's to invite scorn and derision.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. And yet, you know, I can't help but, you know, pour one out for my homies, my poor white homies who are struggling at times to understand like how to navigate a world where they understand. I think a lot of us do understand intellectually that we have been the recipient of good fortune. We have been the recipient of breaks that maybe other people didn't get. How do we navigate into a world where we acknowledge that and want to be good dudes? Mm. And at the same, until we're confronted with it affecting us personally. And then you go, whoa, I didn't mean it was going to affect me. Like, I'll give you an example. Like in my industry, in show business, you know, I've been an actor for, I don't know, 25, 30 years, whatever it is. And it used to be, up until very recently, like there were parts on TV shows, whatever it was, that when you're looking for the funny guy, like you're going to guys like me. You're going to like sort of funny, quirky, whatever, white dudes like me. The last 4 or 5 years, that's changed. Like those parts, like they're all going, we want a diverse cast. We want to find like all kinds of new people. We want to cast maybe a woman where we didn't think a woman would be. Like, and I feel that really keenly. Like there is a direct correlation between these large movements that are happening around the country and my own ability to earn an income. Mm-hmm. And as a white dude, you go, I support everything that's happening, and yet I'm freaking out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it is an interesting proposition now, if we're talking about now limiting your opportunity to work, I guess. So are you saying, A, you're going to go unhinged? Or, you know, if we get to this point, are we further marginalizing these very white males that seem so pissed off that are doing the shootings that now, although they were messed up before, and now all of a sudden we're in a world where they're basically supposed to, I don't know, feel guilt for white guilt? You know, are we further getting into a situation where they're even more upset?
It's really tough because, you know, you don't want to be, nobody wants to hear poor white guys, you know, nobody wants to like, you know, feel like white guys need to be hugged and told it's going to be all right when the rest of the culture has been screaming bloody murder for the past however many hundred years of our nation's existence. So yeah. There is a period of adaptation that is happening. Now, the way I look at it and try to look at it, in the short term, there will be suffering for people. There always is as change happens. And look, you know, like again, like I have a library letter, like I'm going to be fine. There's people in this country, dudes in this country who have seen, and again, going back to this Trump thing, manufacturing jobs disappear, industry jobs disappear. They're seeing competition in those industries domestically that they hadn't had to deal with before. Women, maybe they're opening up more and integrating more in ways that they hadn't before because they were kind of protective and insular. It has to happen. It has to happen if we're going to achieve the dream of who we say we are. It has to happen. There has to be, you know, equal opportunities as we can get. And there's always going to be winners. There's always going to be losers. Right now, in this moment, a lot of white guys are panicking. And what's funny is a lot of times you'll see that it's white guys like me who are panicking, guys who maybe even aren't literally getting the shaft or suffering, but see the sort of coming demographic changes and going, you know, where's that going to leave me? The chances are, if you're good at your job and like you're competent and you're a good person and you're not antisocial and whatever else, the chances are you'll be fine. One of the things that I don't think a lot of guys understand, and maybe it's because we've been instructed to not understand this, is that the pie of, you know, let's say the economy, it's not one size. Like as more people do well, the pie grows. As more people are brought into the economy and perform better and get more opportunities, those people, some of them are going to start businesses. Some of them are going to be hiring. Some of them are going to hire you. Like the pie will grow when everybody's able to participate as fully as they can. It's a good thing ultimately, but it scares a lot of guys. And I understand that. I really do. Because it scares me.
Yeah. So yesterday we're getting, people who listen to this podcast know that I say this probably every freaking show, but I have 24 and 21 year old daughters, but I have little boys. And so they're almost three, they're twins, and we're getting them ready to go to a dinner on Easter. We're recording this on the Monday after Easter. And, neither one liked me putting stuff in their hair. They had bedhead. They got up from a nap. They looked crazy. And I'm like, I'm just going to put some gel in your hair. They both freak out. And Blake, our bigger of the two, they're twins, but one's bigger, goes, oh, I don't want anything in my hair and I'm going to hit you. I'm like, what? This kid, I mean, you talk about coddled. So, I mean, no kid has ever been coddled before more than this kid. And his reaction was that he verbalized. He's like, oh, I don't want anything in my hair, and I want to hit you. And I guarantee you my daughters never said that about anything. Like, now, they may have been upset, and they may have cried, and they may, but not like, I want to punch you in the face. So I do think there is something different in the way, you know, males are brought into this world and what's in the DNA of a male compared to a female. There's an aggression that I just didn't see with my two daughters that I raised 20 years ago.
I would say I agree with all of that. And I would only put the caveat on average, meaning like boys on average, I think do express more aggressive behavior, but it's important to acknowledge, I think, that male behavior may, you know, rise and fall on one bell curve, and female behavior may rise and fall on another bell curve, but there is overlap. And it's, I think, important to acknowledge with our own kids and with the culture at large, like if you've got an aggressive little girl, she's still your little girl. If you've got a very shy and sensitive little boy, like he's still your little boy. Like, there's plenty of the reason that's important is because we are so quick culturally to pigeonhole that's boy behavior, that's girl behavior,
right?
And we know that that ends up having detrimental results in the long run. Like I'll give you an example. Like my son growing up was probably much more, or I know he was, acquiescent to somebody like putting hair gunk in his head when he didn't want it. And my daughter's the one who would have fought tooth and nail against something that she didn't want. She definitely was the more aggressive of the two. She probably still is. They're 20 and 17 now.
And you're still putting stuff in their hair.
You have to.
You do. You don't want to show up with a bad head with your kid.
It's a reflection on you. You don't want to look bad. So,
when you're living the kind of upscale Connecticut lifestyle that I am,
yes,
and people come over, you don't want
the country clubs.
Yes, you don't want your kids looking like schlubs.
The social clubs, yes. The drinking clubs, the card days,
yes,
the hunting that with the fox and the hounds and the I know.
We are forever fox hunting where I am. We bring up ponies and we just go to town and you have your hair in place.
Yes, you do.
Funny because I've got with my two boys, I don't focus on specifics of how I'm going to parent them. I just want them to be good people and I try to communicate with them and be super open and upfront. I don't hide anything from them. You know what I mean? And I have conversations with them and I have a teenager, a 13-year-old whose friends now are dabbling in vaping and weed and instead of just not talking about it, I'm like, "Hey, look, here's the deal. Here's what's happening. You know, come to me, talk to me about what you're feeling." Well, there hasn't been an opportunity yet. I don't think that they're those kinds of kids quite yet. Now, I probably bother them with the question like, "Hey, you smoking weed yet, kid?" You know, and they're like, "Dad, no. I mean, Jesus, no, it's not."
Yeah, I mean, you know they're lying to you, right?
I don't think they are quite yet. You know, I don't think they're lying quite yet. I just want them to get good weed.
Wait. When you look back, Michael, and you're out of the puberty stuff with your kids, now they're young adults. When you look back on their childhood, this is a totally general question and maybe unanswerable, but when you look back, do you think, as you sit here now, I fostered a relationship where I'm more friends with my kids, or the dad disciplinarian? Were they tough kids to raise? Were they easier kids to raise? Were you, you know, were you pulling your hair out? Were you not? I don't know. Just generally speaking.
My son mercilessly mocks me whenever he feels like I'm doing something dad-like. Mm-hmm. Whenever he feels like I'm trying to be a dad, he just laughs in my face. So I guess
you mean like trying to putting on the dad
like
voice,
like give advice, like, you know, the like son, sit down. Let me tell you, you know,
right,
that kind of thing. She's just like, shut up, you know.
Right.
I guess maybe I failed on that front.
No, I think that in a roundabout way, I think that's good. I think that's you know, like the kid's smart enough and wise enough to know, oh, here's my dad trying to be a dad. I'm going to just pull the plug out and just put him in his place because isn't
like,
working.
I know who you are. Stop trying to play.
You've been
this
in
role
movies. You write stuff. You're a funny guy. This doesn't work on me. Try again.
Right. So that's definitely true. My daughter, she presented more challenges. She's just a tougher nut to crack than my son was.
But what about how you're dealing with sort of again the landscape of today and the Me Too movement and women and all of that, because she was right in that, you know, spot of 15, 16, 17 years old. I mean, did you have conversations?
It's tough with her. This is one of the reasons she's so tough, is because she is so private. And so, I don't know if secretive is the right word, maybe, but she won't talk to us. Like she just will. Like if we try to talk to her about anything of any consequence, the mask comes over her face and she just will not participate. That being said, what I think I've learned is the way to get through to her is to talk around her at a dinner table. Like my wife and I will have a conversation about the Me Too movement that doesn't involve her. You know what I mean? And she's just sitting there, you know what I mean? Pretending to ignore us. And I do think those conversations, despite the fact that she refuses to participate in them.
She won't chip in the middle of the conversation?
No, almost never.
Because my youngest of my two daughters is that way. But it's funny you say that because I don't think I realize that I do that. But I will intentionally bring things up in the group setting with her sister there, my wife, her little brothers, that, you know, is to generate, but my target is her. I want her to talk. And every once, you know, she'll get in and she's really wise. She's smarter than I am and she'll jump in. But that's brilliant. And I think I do that to some degree. I never thought about that until now, because if you go right in on her, she has no patience for that and just will shut down.
Yeah. That's how my daughter is.
But do you give them, it's trust too. I mean, I feel like you can only do so much as a parent, and then they're 17, then they turn 18. Then it's like, okay, I hope you listen to me. I hope when we were talking around you, you soak some of this stuff up, because now I just have to trust that you're going to go out into the world and make good choices, I guess. Yeah, and that's a scary proposition.
Well, part of my thinking as a parent is always like, you do what you can, and whether you trust them or not, it's almost irrelevant.
That's a great point. That's a great point, though. It's not about trust.
I mean, no, but what you hope is, or what I hope is, not so much that I trust them, but that they trust myself and my wife enough so that if there is a screw up, if there is something they need, if they need help, whatever it is, that they know we have their backs always. Mm-hmm. You know, that the message we've sent to them throughout is, you may do something stupid and you may piss us off and whatever, but at the end of the day, not even at the end of the day, anytime during the day, like, we're going to be here, you know? And there's no situation that you can find yourself in that we're not going to be there to support you and love you and do what we can. And I hope having that kind of backstop in your brain as a kid allows you to enter the world with slightly more confidence than you might have otherwise.
And how much of how you do things, how much of how you parent, I guess personally and with your wife, but how much of it is informed by your childhood, the way that you were raised, your relationship with your parents, you know, and how much of it is actually railing against the way that you were raised?
The combination. I grew up in a weird environment. My mom and dad divorced when I was 5 because my mom was sleeping with the lady down the street. And so I grew up in a lesbian household at a time where there was really no cachet there. That wasn't like the thing to do. And so we grew up with my mom's partner and her son, and the partner was like angry. She was abusive. We still saw my dad. He died when I was 12. I didn't really get to know him very well, just as a guy. And so some of the things that I feel like were really wrong and destructive in the household that I grew up in, I've certainly tried to model against. But there were certain things that my mom did really well. You know, one of the things she did really well was she said, as simple as it is, I love you. She said it all the time. You know, she said it every day, multiple times a day. And I didn't really hear it at the time, but I feel like it got absorbed into my DNA. I feel like that's an important thing to have in the cells of your being, to know that you are loved and to not doubt that, to never question that. And I've been really conscious about that as my kids grew up, to let them know, like, just tell them, I love you. I love you. I love you. Hold them, hug them, kiss them, whatever it is. And my wife too. And I mean, I don't tell my wife I love her, God forbid, but my wife also tells them that they're loved. And I do think that that's important. And I hope that pays dividends for them down the road.
Now, this is maybe, you know, again, it's become sort of not a PC thing to say or do, but, you know, as far as having a man in your life, as far as having that masculine energy, getting back to that, you know, which your dad passed away when you were 12, you had some of it, but you didn't have a lot of it. You know, and again, today it's kind of a hard thing to say because you would probably, you know, bordering on being canceled if you said that, oh, I needed a man in my life, you know?
No, I'm clear about it. I'm really vocal about it. I really think it's important to have a man in your life as a guy, as a boy. Mm-hmm. I keenly felt the absence of it, you know? Not only because my dad died when he was young, but also because even when he was alive, we didn't see him. We saw him every other weekend, and he worked like a dog, and like in the very specific household that I was raised in, did not allow for a lot of male energy or praise. So, like I really keenly felt the absence of it. And even though I couldn't have put it into words at the time, I really questioned what it meant to be a man. Like I really didn't know, you know, and I spent a lot of time like trying to figure that out for myself without any real guidance. And there were men in my life who I think at times tried to reach out a little bit, and I always sort of pulled back. I think maybe I was afraid of developing like that kind of relationship with an adult man, like as a mentor or something. And I regret that now. But well, I think
it's for deeper reasons. Because it's scary almost. It's like what we're talking about right now. Like it's almost it's scary to say, oh, you know, I need a man in my life. Masculinity is still an important thing.
Yeah.
And of course there's toxic masculinity. There's no doubt about it, but it's almost like toxic masculinity has gotten lumped into those two words. Yeah. You know,
that's why I like in my book, I'm careful to say, like, I don't use that term for that reason.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a healthy model of masculinity. We don't quite know like what masculinity even really is.
Yes.
That adjective toxic affixes itself so easily to it that, that you're right. Like those two words have become really well lumped together, and it sucks. So I try to avoid it because for that very reason.
If you're enjoying this episode of Daddy Issues,
I am.
Don't keep it to yourself then.
I will.
Okay, good. Share the love. Tell a friend about Daddy Issues. Go subscribe to the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody, go check out and subscribe to Daddy Issues. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss the rest of our conversation with Michael Ian Black coming up right after this short break. Do you have anybody in your life right now that can give you a better picture of who your father was?
Yeah. And I wrote another book before this one that was a little bit more about that. And I wrote about a book about my mom and myself. Part of that involved doing more research into my dad. And I do feel like I have a much better sense of him now as an adult than in the last few years than I did up until now. It's funny when, you know, I'm 10 years older now than my dad ever was. And in a way that makes me feel oddly close to him. Like I feel like in a weird way, like I'm kind of carrying him with me now and having a life that he was unable to have. It's meaningful to me. It's meaningful to me to like feel that sense of my father walking with me as I move forward and as I raise these kids and my kids go off to college, you know, stuff that he never got to see. It's impactful for me.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. That's
beautiful.
Makes me emotional. Yeah. I've had an interesting relationship with my father, so I've got all kinds of crazy shit, but you know, Kurt came into my life when I was 6 or 7 years old. And my mom has been divorced for 2 years, and I didn't have masculinity in my life. And then Kurt came in.
So he gets Snake
masculine. Man, I get Snake Plissken. And it changed the trajectory of my life for sure, you know, without a doubt. He showed me what masculinity is and was, and there's others, there's different sides of it. Some of it I took in and some of it I didn't want, you know. It's a great question, is the definition. How do we define masculinity? It seems to be just put into a box of, you know, beat you over the head and drag you into the cave and fucking eat meat and get drunk and blah. That's just the stereotype of masculinity. But I think it's so much deeper than that, and there has not been a real exploration of it. You know, I'm fascinated with all that.
It's right. I mean, if I say to you at any given moment, be a man, like, we all kind of instinctively know what that means, but we'd have a hard time really defining it, what does that mean? Be a man. I am a man by nature of my nature. Like, that's who I am. It's how I think of myself. So if I do X, if I exhibit X behavior, am I no longer a man? If I exhibit Y behavior, am I no longer a man? I mean, it's nonsense on the face of it. And we've, and the parallel is, we've done so much work culturally with women that we now understand, I think most of us, that if a woman exhibits strength, physical or otherwise, it does not diminish the fact that she's a woman. In a lot of ways, it enhances it. We celebrate strong women, right? We want our girls to grow up to be strong women. And yet, if you flip that with guys and you say, what would be the flip, a vulnerable, a tender, whatever it is, boy, some part of us culturally is still considering that boy suspect. Some part of us is still going, well, you know, how is he going to be as a man? Is he going to be gay? Is he going to be weak? Is he going to be whatever? Not ever recognizing that part of him is as valid as the strength in the woman or the strength in him. Like, we're all full human beings. Like, we all have all of this within us. And it's important to acknowledge, recognize, celebrate, and appreciate, like, we're all fully dimensional. So when you say be a man, like, I don't know what that means.
Right. It's a man up.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That I've never thought of it in those terms. And you're right. When you always hear the phrase toxic masculinity, and masculinity can be the proper way to treat your spouse, the proper way to discipline your kid, you know, or be a man. Like, that's not supposed to hurt. Well, it's okay to let that hurt. And yes, it does hurt. My leg's hanging off, whatever it might be. I can't just rub dirt on it and say, now I'm a man. And it's interesting, Michael, to watch you talk and to see the work that you've done. And I wonder if there was ever a shift with you, if you know, over a period of time you woke up and you said, I can do more. And this is not to diminish everything you did early on in your career and in your life, but
sounds like maybe you are. It's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, nah. No. But I feel like you got a platform because of your comedy, and you got your platform because of your acting ability and everything else. And you said, I also want to give you my thoughts on where we are as a country, where we are as parents, where we are as men and women in society. That's a compliment. I'm not diminishing one. I'm just saying it feels like if somebody sees, you know, for the guy that was Bradley Cooper's best on-screen kiss in Wet Hot American Summer, now we're talking about pretty heavy stuff. I mean, that there has to have been, you know, some sort of mental shift or philosophical shift with you.
What happened with me specifically was that I had built the early mid part of my career on being sardonic and sarcastic and being very dry. And that had served me pretty well. I was making a living doing that. But when I got married and when I started having kids and when I started to realize, like, that very dry, in a way, masculine persona that I had created for I mean, nobody ever accused me of being too masculine, but that guardedness, that's a sort of classic masculine thing. it started to feel more and more imprisoning. It started to feel like the person who I was portraying was not the fullness of who I was. And I wasn't comfortable with that anymore. And I needed to find a way to get out of it. I needed to find, just psychologically, I needed to figure out a way to be the person that I wanted to be with my family and for my own mental well-being. And that meant, for me, figuring out ways to reconstruct myself personally, which had a direct effect on the way I presented myself professionally as well.
So you had to make that choice, though, to reconstruct yourself.
It was a choice. It was absolutely a choice. Yeah.
How has that enhanced, do you think, your performance? Has that enhanced your writing, your comedic writing?
In a lot of ways, it was like a terrible professional decision. Because there's always, as we were talking, I was literally ripping off my toenail, and now I'm bleeding all over the floor.
Oh, good. Well, be a man, for God's sake.
Did you hear me crying about it, Joe? Did you hear me crying about it?
I'm wiping blood off the floor.
Oh, my God.
And licking my fingers. And I forgot the question.
Do you think it's enhanced what you've done on screen, or is it?
In some ways, it was a bad decision.
Made you think twice.
In some ways, it was a bad professional decision, because there'll always be a market for that kind of like super deadpan, sarcastic dude, and I can still, you know, do that. But there's less of a market for, like, you know, middle-aged sensitive guy who's questioning everything and doing so in a kind of effeminate manner. Like, there's less of a market for that.
I think it's growing, honestly. I do. I think that you are ahead of your time, and give it a couple years and then you will be in the sweet spot of that.
Once the bank repossesses the library ladder.
Yeah.
Have
you made all your payments on that yet?
The ladder is paid for. The house is not.
Okay. All right. Good. That's all you'll be clinging to, as they take everything else away. Not my ladder.
Not the ladder. Not the ladder. I'll be carrying like Jesus with the cross walking through the streets of Nazareth or Jerusalem, wherever the hell he was walking. I should know this the day after Easter. I'm Jewish, guys. I'm Jewish.
It's so funny, though, to think about Wet Hot American Summer and some of those characters. I mean, you talk about like either toxic masculinity or just the quintessential dumbass.
Oh, yeah.
That was a movie about like these. Well, everybody's kind of an
idiot,
but
one of the great fucking comedies, honestly. I mean,
it's so great. It's so smart. It's so dry. It's so
fucking funny.
I don't know. It's just, you got to look back and go, wow, that was a different time.
Oh, yeah. But it was made by people who are like looking at camp movies of the 80s and, you know, embracing what we liked about it. And also,
how ridiculous they were.
Yeah. How ridiculous it was and how bad a lot of the behavior was and all of that.
No, I know, but again, at the time, it wasn't bad behavior, I guess. But now, you know, you looking back on it, it is, and that's getting into this whole sort of cancel culture where the pendulum is swinging so far that there's even a backlash in a way. It's starting to happen where it's like, okay, well, hold on, let's get straight here, you know. And it's not equitable, honestly, because if you have already created a persona prior to this cancel culture of irreverence and being dark and saying things that are un-PC, you're almost free. I mean, Howard Stern is like an idol of mine. He will never be canceled. But if you go back into his archives, I mean, it's crazy shit.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
But Howard Stern wouldn't be doing the things that he was doing now. And also,
sure.
One in particular, I feel like, has been very sort of upfront about his own like evolution just as a dude, you know? I mean, he can still be crass and whatever, but I feel like, you know,
nowadays
he's a lot more thoughtful than he was.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But that's the thing, is there's probably a lot of people who have changed, you know, who are more thoughtful because that's just how we are now. But they will get picked apart from their past.
Oh yeah. No, I still get that all the time. I mean, I've made atrocious jokes in the past And, you know, I get reminded of them on a nearly daily basis. And what are you going to do? I mean, that's what I did. And
do you feel like you have to apologize for those jokes?
I would apologize for things. If like I had offended somebody specific, I would absolutely apologize. Or if I had offended, like, I guess, like if I had made like some sort of horrific, you know, a transphobic joke or something, I guess I would apologize for it now. I don't think I did. And I don't think I had to. But the one thing that I will say about comedians and the idea of cancel culture and the idea of political correctness, one of the upsides, I think, of it is that comedians in particular are having to be far more thoughtful about their material. Mm. And I think that can only be a good thing. You know, there was a time where you could get on stage and just be like, hey, that guy's gay, and get a laugh. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we're past that. And I think that's good from just like a craft point of view, from like, not, you know, set aside a human point of view, just from a craft point of view, like, just think about what you're saying, say, do some, you know, have intentionality, have purpose to it. And I think that's actually a good thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I wrote a book and was talking about the difference in my profession, just sports announcing and stuff that my dad said. You know, I followed him into the business, and stuff that he said in the 70s and in the 80s that I don't know that he would have finished the game if he did it now. And somebody interviewed me from the Village Voice and said, it seems like you're saying that was a better time. And I'm saying, and my answer was, no, I'm just saying it was a different time.
Yeah.
And it's my dad, and I'm wistful for my dad and some of the funny lines that he had during the course of a broadcast, but it's changed, and that's good, especially as being a father of two girls and being married to somebody that's a female in the sports broadcasting business. I am much more aware of why that stuff was not right back then. It just was a different time. And I think you have to, that's okay to be able to say that. The different doesn't mean that it's better,
no.
Better back then. And I'm with you. I think it's a good thing that we're more aware of the shrapnel that comes out if you're saying something off the cuff that may really hurt somebody. And you know, as a father to two girls, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it can't not be, I don't think. I mean, I think we still have the freedom to express ourselves however we want. We understand that there may be different consequences if we say things that are hurtful. And I bet your dad, or any of our dads, had they been sort of undergoing the cultural shifts that we're undergoing and being made aware of pain that they might be causing, like, nobody wants to cause pain. Like, they, no. You know, they would make adjustments to handle that, you know, because most of us want to be good people.
Exactly.
So Michael, creatively, where are you at right now? What are you doing? I know you got your podcast, but just, you know,
genius.
Get on that one.
Please just explain to our listeners what your podcast is, because I can't imagine how the idea came up, but the idea that you're reading this book over time that your wife refused to throw away and then fucking making genius comments is just so smart and so funny.
So the podcast is called Obscure, so named because the book that you're referring to is Jude the Obscure by Thomas Hardy, which was sitting on one of these bookshelves for over 20 years with nobody reading it. And me repeatedly saying, can I please throw this away? Along with other 19th century paperbacks that nobody's ever going to read. No, you can't. It's a classic. I'm like, well, there was more than one copy made. Like, we're not destroying the only copy of Jude the Obscure. So finally, I was undergoing one of my periods of unemployment, certainly not my first, and I just was looking for something to do. So I just sort of on a whim said, all right, I'm going to do a podcast where I read this book out loud and comment on it as I go. Having never read it, knowing nothing about it, knowing that there would be almost no audience for this, because why would there be? And so the title Obscure is a play both on the title of the book and on my own career and on the fact that this is never going to find an audience. So 75
great fucking idea. Sorry, go ahead.
It's really not. It's such a dumb.
It is. It's no, dumb, but it's genius. You know. It's great. Let me ask you a question. Have you learned? I mean, reading this book for the first time and commenting as you go in real time. Have you actually taken shit from it? Were you? Yeah. You know, from a deeper perspective, like and learn something about yourself.
Well, so I finished it. So that was 75 episodes of Thomas Hardy, Jude the Obscure, and ended up feeling like, oh, I get why it's a classic. Like, it's a great book. And like, I would go pretty deep. Like, I was not just like making, you know, dumb jokes. Like, I was doing my best to kind of analyze it as I was going, knowing, you know, like, I don't know anything about anything. So there was humor in that, I hope. So then I took a little break from it. And now season two is I'm reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I never had any desire to read, just like with Jude the Obscure, no desire. Really didn't know what it was about other than the idea of Boris Karloff going like that. And it's a much different book than I expected.
But it's great.
Great.
That book's great.
I love like that it? Book.
I didn't. I let me say this. Up until recently, I'm a little more than halfway through. I didn't really like it. Now I'm starting to dig it. It took me about half of the book, though.
What would it mean to you if someday there's some, you know, college graduate degree that's based on the Thomas Hardy book and your podcast is seminal to the learning experience of
do I receive any kind of royalty
doctorate
is there merchandising opportunity?
There's merchandising,
and yes, then I'm all for it.
Thomas Hardy the lunchbox, there's two Tom Hardys, there's Bane, and then there's this guy. I'm the other Tom Hardy. Yeah, I think there's opportunity here, and I would start pitching it. Have your people pitch it to Harvard. I would start Ivy League.
Okay, yeah, I think that's smart. I'm going to do that.
In the neighborhood.
Oh, they're very, very smart. I'm going to do that.
Are you acting? You doing anything?
Oh, I'm so unemployed, Oliver.
I know.
So very. I mean, you know, this whole last year was just a disaster for the globe and for my industry in particular. It's starting to pick up a little bit now, but it is a lot of sitting around and having plenty of time to do podcasts. Mm-hmm. If somebody says, "Hey, you want to be on my podcast?" I have time for that.
Well, thank you for making time for us, man.
My pleasure.
Sorry. This was honestly one of my favorite. I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. This was a really important conversation. It's shit that I think about as a father raising my boys and my little girl, who's, by the way, tough as nails. We didn't even get into that because she's so feminine, but she's got her two brothers. So she's badass, you know, with a dress on, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's just been really freeing to talk about this. I mean, I've yet to even have this discussion. Joe doesn't have the mental capacity to deal with these kinds of things. So it's nice to. thank you, brother. This is really, really fun.
Thanks, Michael.
Oh, yeah. No, my total pleasure. It was really fun for me, too.
Good. All right. Get on that ladder. Go sliding around with your bleeding toe.
All right. We'll do.
Spray blood all over those white shelves. All right, man. Be well.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Thanks. All right.
See you, buddy.
Bye.
How fucking great is he? Jesus.
He's great. He's very smart. And that's what I always heard from Rudd about him. And you can see it, you know, with what he's done. And he's on The State and all these different kind of higher brow comedy. And when I said it, and then I started thinking back on me saying it, as we were discussing Wet Hot American Summer, the brilliance in it is shining a light on kind of those old camp movies. And it really is. All the characters are morons, but that's the joke. And they're making fun of the whole idea of these stupid camp movies. Which, by the way, I love too, like Meatballs.
Yeah,
was a great movie.
Meatballs is the greatest.
I mean, you know, that's Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And Woody the Wabbit and all these, you know, Fink and the two camps and the rich camp and the poor camp and all that. Mm-hmm. I loved that movie, but it is kind of ridiculous. And some of the characters are so overblown with their.
Yeah. Act. He's just. I like the topics that he's talking about. I think that they're important topics. The topic of masculinity, again, not just boxing it into this stereotype of what it is, talking to our boys, you know, giving them some insight as to the shifts that are happening culturally and not just putting them out there in the world. You know, I think it's important to pay attention. And he's shining a light on that, and it's different. It's not mainstream right now. Masculinity is definitely, again, that toxic masculinity has seemed to take over all masculinity, and that's not fair. You know?
Yeah, now you can't generalize that. And I think masculinity can be a positive, and is an important part of who we are as men, and that's okay to talk about. Yes,
it is.
We're middle-aged, or I'm more middle-aged than you are, white guys and privileged white guys. And so it becomes hard to even really open up that line of conversation because it's like, well, we don't really haven't experienced anything because of who and what
we
are.
But we've experienced what we've experienced. You know what I mean? Like, I talk about this all the time with, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm lucky as fuck, man. Number one, born white. Born to a celebrity parents, it's not lost on me, but that doesn't mean that I can't feel pain and hurt and discomfort and confusion and trying to figure my life out. You know,
right? Those are all emotions that you seem to experience while on the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, when you're pushing that hard, you get emotional.
Maybe that's what'll make you sweat eventually.
Just some butthole sweating.
Yeah, just straining to get something out. Like, do not ever go the Metamucil route. You need to develop. If for every hemorrhoid you develop, another
pore opens.
Stone across the stream, eventually being able to sweat will be put in place.
Yeah, it's like for every angel. What is the Christmas movie?
Every time an angel gets its wings.
It's a Wonderful Life, right? So it's A Wonderful Life for my sweat glands. It's
every time you get a hemorrhoid, a new sweat pore opens up. about dumbing down something that really has you off your game. I apologize for even getting into that area.
Nah, it's good. It's good. This is what I love about our podcast, dude. We go from one weird fucking topic to the next, and we get serious and we get dumb. You know, we're doing us, Joseph. But that was
fun. I need a library ladder back behind me.
You do. I just need a library first before I get
a ladder. Well, these are just shelves. I mean, I'm not in a library. They're shelves. You're in Rio's room.
I know because, you know, my daughter was sleeping in my bed last night and I didn't want to wake her up, so.
It looks like a Care Bear room.
It is. It's very colorful. It's like a big Easter egg exploded in here.
It is, and it's a purple wall with pink paint on the trimming up top.
Mm-hmm.
And then what kind of a bed? Is that like a red bed?
It's like a turquoise bed with like a pinky frame. You know,
that's pink. Yeah.
I
was going to say, if that's like dark red, I can see you dragging that into your room for you and Aaron. Dark red leather bed.
Yes. Oh, that's a good choice. That's more you and Michelle. I think, you know, you're more sort of the patent leather kind of couple. you know.
I do like some patent leather.
Yes.
I don't. Yeah, we don't really have any.
That's more your speed. It's like outfits, patent leather, strappy things, you know, sort of like that. Aaron and I are more, you know, ripped tank tops and cute little boy shorts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but what does she wear?
You did it. You did it. Let's end on that. Yeah, let's end right there.
I did it. I love seeing you in a ripped tank top. Boy shorts.
I look cute.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe. Sorry I yelled at you. But
it's okay. I'm okay.
Okay, you're okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Good.
I love you.
Bye.
Listen to Daddy Issues on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Daddy Issues is a production of Cavalry Audio and iHeartMedia, produced by Margo Carmichael.
Sound engineering and editing by Josh Windisch.
Executive produced by Joe Bach, Oliver Hudson, Dana Brunetti, and Keegan Rosenberger.